Today is Halloween, October 31st. It's a day that we celebrate with candy and costumes and decorating and trick-or-treating or trunk-or-treating, as the case may be. In this country, Halloween is big business. According to the National Retail Association, Halloween spending this year is projected to reach an all-time high of $10 billion. That, however, is a large number, but still less than half of what we spend at Valentine's Day. So I guess candy corn still bows down to chocolate. So how is it that we decided that on October 31st of each year that we would dress up as pirates and go house to house begging for M&Ms? Well, the origins of Halloween, they're a bit murky, understandably. It is, however, believed that the roots of this celebration can be found in the ancient Celtic New Year's festival called Samhain. The Celts of Ireland, Britain, and northern France observed their New Year's Day on November the 1st. Their end-of-year celebration was not just a harvest festival, it was also It also entertained supernatural aspects. The Celts believed that on that final night of the year that the spirits of the dead would come out and haunt the living. And so, to appease these spirits, they would place gifts of food and wine on their doorsteps. And if they needed to leave their homes for any reason, they would wear masks or costumes so that they might fool the ghouls. Now, this tradition most likely would have died out over time, if not for the Christian church. In the 9th century, Pope Gregory IV moved the observance of All Saints to November 1st, where we have it today. All Saints' Day, which we will observe next Sunday, was originally placed on May the 13th. So, why did the Pope make this change from May to November? Well, possibly his motive was to eclipse the popular celebration of that Celtic pagan festival, Samhain. And if that was his intention, then it worked. He also, in moving All Saints' Day, elevated All Saints' Day to become a high church feast. In the Middle Ages, vigils were commonly held on the night before certain high church feasts, so it was natural that a vigil would be held on the eve of All Saints' Day now that it was a high church feast. And this vigil would coincide with the Celtic festival and hopefully overshadow it. Now, in Old English, the word saint is hallow. And so All Saints' Day was known as All Hallows' Day. And the day before All Hallows' Day was All Hallows' Eve, which the Scots, in their wonderful way, took it and made it into Halloween. A few centuries later, in Britain, in the 16th century, on All Hallows' Eve, young people took to dressing up in costumes and going house to house, singing, telling jokes, or reciting poetry in return for treats from the homeowner. They call it guising, still call it that today. And the Irish and Scottish immigrants brought this practice to America in the late 19th century, and it eventually took hold as trick-or-treating in the 1940s in this country. Now, if you would like to draw an historic connection between Halloween and then you're going to have a tough time. It's not really there. However, the roots of Halloween are found within the very real human fear of death. For Christians, the fear of death is embedded in our awareness of the spiritual realities. We know that God is real. And we know that, yes, we have sinned, and consequently, we feel estranged from God. We feel lost. We feel that all hope has abandoned us. And our sin makes us feel as if God has been playing a great trick on us for which there is no treat. Today, in addition to being Halloween, which falls on a Sunday, it is also Reformation Day, as Michael mentioned. For it was on October 31st, 1517, that the German priest Martin Luther published what has become known as the 95 Theses. And 4 years ago, we celebrated the 500th anniversary of that date. Now, tradition tells us that Luther nailed the document to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg, Germany, so people could read it. I don't really believe that. I think it's more likely that he probably posted them on a bulletin board at or near the church. I mean, it's a really nice church, and I doubt they look kindly to priests putting nails in the door. I mean, we wouldn't like it if somebody started nailing in our wooden doors here. This document, Luther's 95 Theses, was actually titled Disputation on the Power and Efficacy of Indulgences. And it contained Luther's thoughts on the church's practice of permitting local priests to sell these indulgences, thus allowing believers to purchase their salvation. Now, the purpose of Luther's document was academic and was intended to simply initiate a discussion among other academics as well as the church hierarchy. However, these 95 theses struck a nerve with people, and it was quickly reprinted across Europe, and Luther's words became the catalyst for the Protestant Reformation. But why did Luther post his writings on October 31st? Was that just a random date? No. Luther, it appears, chose this day because it was the day before All Saints. It wasn't Halloween at that time in Germany, but it was the day before All Saints, and he knew that on the following day, there would be a great number of people attending Mass at the church. Luther knew that he would have an interested audience and a large audience for his writings. Although Luther's document changed the course of history, was it a trick or was it a treat? Was Luther trying to stir up trouble with the church, or did he seek something more? Well, as a priest, Luther never intended to split away from the church. He loved his church. His 95 theses were simply the words of a concerned believer who viewed the practice of selling indulgences to be, well, let's say less than ill-advised. Luther was not opposed to indulgences himself, but believed that they should be obtained through prayer and penance, the old-fashioned way, not bought with gold. Now, he may have intended to stir things up, but he wasn't trying to trick anyone by any means. The church, however, did not agree with Luther and demanded that he denounce his own words. Luther refused. And in 1521, just 4 years later, he was excommunicated. Our reading from Scripture for today comes to us from the words of the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah. This man, Jeremiah, had been called by God to be a prophet about 627 BC. About 30 years into his career as a prophet, his country, Judah, was invaded by the Babylonians, and the capital, Jerusalem, was captured. And many of the residents of Judah and Jerusalem were taken away forcibly into exile back to Babylon. Jeremiah managed to stay behind. And he chose to remain and minister to those who were attempting to rebuild their lives after the decimation of their nation, after the burning of their capital, after the destruction of the great temple, after so many of their neighbors had been taken away. Now, up to this point in his ministry, most of Jeremiah's work had been preaching judgment to the people and the kings of Judah and Israel. He was harsh, but fair. But after the fall of Jerusalem, he changed his message radically to emphasize now a message of hope in a time that, well, appeared to be hopeless. I mean, for those people, what hope was there on the horizon? Not much that they could see. Our reading today is one of Jeremiah's oracles of hope. It's found in a section of his book that scholars commonly call the Book of Consolation. You can hear that Jeremiah seeking to console these people who have lost so much. And in the reading that we have for today, we hear Jeremiah tell of God's promise to bring a new covenant to the people. A covenant that will be made with the kingdoms of Israel and Judah that have been lost. Remember, Israel and Judah had fallen to these foreign nations. And the people now, they felt abandoned by their God. The God who brought their ancestors to that land and promised to watch over them. But it didn't seem that God was doing that. And the people feel that maybe God had tricked them. So Jeremiah preaches to these people. And he preaches that God has indeed not abandoned his people. And that God is still with them. And there's a new covenant that God intends to bring to the people. And this new covenant will be different. It won't be like that covenant that God made with the Israelites so many generations ago as they were wandering across the wilderness when the land they lived in was only a promise. Here in this reading, God reminds the people how he delivered them from slavery in Egypt and how in the wilderness God brought them a covenant in the form of the law and the commandments. A covenant, God points out, that the people failed to keep. But now it's time for something new. Something different from God. That previous covenant, that was an external covenant. It was written on stone tablets. The new covenant, it's going to be different. Because God is going to inscribe this new covenant directly on the hearts of the people. God is going to take the law and place it within them. He's going to make it part of them. And so, by doing this, God intends to renew the ancient covenant first made with Abraham, where God said, "I will be your God, and you shall be my people." And then comes the amazing part. This new covenant, because it's inscribed deeply on our hearts, because it is going to be so internalized in their lives, it means that their knowledge of God, their understanding of God, their relationship with God will be second nature. They won't even have to think about it. They won't need to teach one another about the presence of the Lord, because everybody, from the lowest to the greatest, will simply know it. And finally, to make all of this possible, God needs to remove something, and that is sin. God pledges to forgive the sins of the people, but not just forgive, but to forget them as well. I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. I mean, it's one thing to start over with a new covenant, but if we're weighed down with the guilt of our sin, it's going to be hard to adopt. But now God is sweeping that all away and promises to remember their sin no more. The people will start over with a clean slate. And this is no trick. It is God's treat. The treat that God offers to all. The treat of salvation. We don't have to beg for it. It is God's gift to us. The people of Judea and Israel in the 6th century BC were a people who had lost their country, who had and viewed their loss as being a result of their sin against God. And now they were a people who felt that they had lost God, but no. God brings them a new creation, a new beginning. Jeremiah's oracle of hope is that God will forgive, and forget. And it's no trick. God's promise across time is to remain with his people, even if they should turn from him. The ancient Celts chose November 1st as the start of their new year. And Samhain is a term that means end of summer. For Celts, their new year began with winter. And in Northern Europe, winter is a time of darkness, of cold, and even death, a time when life itself seems to be more trick than treat. For us as Christians, sin can be like winter, full of darkness and cold and death. But even in the dark times, the times of exile, we can remember that God is with us and that God has come to us as our Christ. And as Christ, he is, as the Gospel of John puts it, a light that shines in the darkness where we live, and that darkness cannot defeat him. As the prophet Isaiah wrote, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. And during the Reformation, the reformers adopted as their slogan the Latin phrase, post tenebras lux, after darkness, there is light. So, on this All Hallows Eve, in which we gather together in the church, some of us wearing costumes and masks, may we be the people of light, the people of light who know how to embrace the great treat of our God's love. Amen.